and I hope to see several of you. Yeah, I mean, some of the topics are E&M waves and waveguides and cavities, for instance. Next semester we'll cover, I think also we'll do the Kramers-Kronig relations, which is pretty cool stuff. That if you know the real part of the dielectric constant, there's a theorem that tells you the imaginary part at all frequencies. That's a really cool result in Chapter 7. Chapter 8 is about waveguides and cavities, like a laser cavity. Then we do, I think Chapter 9 is radiation by oscillating charges and currents, how an antenna works, how if you wiggle a charge, it sends out light. Then I think we do special relativity and this cool Thomas precession effect that you usually don't see derived in your undergraduate quantum classes that changes spin-orbit interaction if you neglect that effect. There's also then the relativistic Lagrangian dynamics of particles and fields. Again, more relativistic motion of charged particles, how they radiate. And then this weird effect I've already alluded to, if you wiggle a charge, it sends out electromagnetic waves, and those act back on the particle itself and leads to a very complicated thing that turned out to be, trying to understand that was Richard Feynman's PhD thesis at Princeton. So those are the main topics for next semester, if they interest you. And as I've said before, the homework load is quite a bit less than this semester. Okay, where are we? Yes, now we are up to, and here's the final exam details. Just a reminder, it'll be Tuesday, a week from this coming Tuesday. On the 16th, 8 to 10 a.m. in this room, not in BHEE, as it's written in the final exam official schedule. I'll roughly try to weight the problems. This is an inexact science, but I'll try to make it approximately 60% over the material since the midterm, 40% the earlier stuff. There'll be Green's functions. Fear not. You've invested a lot in that. I wouldn't deny you the chance to show that you've figured out Green's functions. Bring your own blank paper and a sheet of notes with two sides. Do not bring two sides, two papers with one side. I'm a real stickler about that. I have no idea why. Okay. Today we'll finish Chapter 6, at least what I want to cover in Chapter 6.
Do we have classes next week?
Yeah. Okay. Is there some reason you don't want class next week?
Oh, yeah.
You don't especially want class?
Especially if we solve exercises like in the exam. If we ask them.
I wasn't planning to do that. I was planning to lecture in Chapter 7, since you're graduate students and you're all very hungry to learn new material.
Yeah.
Hasn't been enough yet this semester. Maybe.
Yeah, we have another semester with ENM 2.
Mm-hmm. Just think how much fun we're going to have. There's some pretty cool physics. Why is the sky blue? We will understand that. Okay, did I start the recording? Yeah. All right. So I think I had already introduced the topic last time when we ran out of time. This is one more look at Poynting's theorem, but in a slightly more complex scenario. And now we'll have not only linear media, meaning there's a dielectric constant and magnetic permeability, but it could have dispersion, meaning that those quantities depend on frequency now, which we haven't encountered up to this point. And also with losses, which means epsilon is not real. And possibly mu is not real, although in most cases it's the imaginary part of epsilon that is the most significant issue here. Okay, so that means we'll still have D is epsilon E, B is mu H, and usually we think of these quantities as functions of position and time, the way Maxwell's equations are written down. And so the way we think about these as frequency-dependent quantities comes after Fourier analysis. So we'll start by Fourier analyzing the fields to see the equations for the different frequency components. All right, so here's the math for that. E of xt we'll write as an integral over all frequencies minus infinity to infinity d omega e of xt, e of x omega times e to the minus I omega t. Can represent any time dependence this through this type of a Fourier transform. You can also do the same with d of xt, integral d omega, d of x omega minus I omega t. And when we are talking about frequency-dependent dielectric constant epsilon and permeability mu, we are taking this relation into the frequency domain. That's how it's usually done. It's better to think of these as frequency-dependent than as time-dependent quantities. We'll analyze that a little bit more next semester, especially when we talk about the Kramers-Kronig relations. So that means now we're going to make the following assumption, that d of x omega in that Fourier representation is epsilon of omega e of x omega, and b of x omega is mu of omega h of x omega. Now, some things have to be true in order for the fields to be real, the final fields like E of xt to be real. In particular, E conjugate of xt, right? We want to equal E of xt. And if you analyze this integral, you see that this implies E of x omega, E of x minus omega, has to equal E conjugate of x omega. in order for that to be guaranteed to be real. And also then we'll have to have epsilon of minus omega has to equal epsilon conjugate of omega. And similarly, d of x minus omega has to equal d star of x omega, etc., for all those quantities. So, coming back, this derivation has some grimy algebra. I'm not going to go through every bit of it on the board, but every bit of it is pretty much in the notes. Something for your vast spare time, but I will go through some of the key aspects of it. One of the terms in Poynting's theorem, in particular, I want to analyze when we proved Poynting's theorem. This was like equation 6.105, was this one, where we have E of xt dotted into the time derivative of d of xt . And I want to analyze this and recast this in terms of the frequency-dependent quantities. Okay, so let's just write it out. We'll write the first term as an integral over a dummy integration variable d omega prime of E star of x omega prime e to the I omega prime t. I can write it this way in terms of E conjugate. Essentially, I've taken E conjugate here from that expression over there. And so it looks a little different. And now that's dotted into this integral. Now I'll use just d omega for the second integral. Have to make sure you don't mix up the dummy integration indices and or variables in the two integrals. Don't make that mistake. All right, if you write two integrals that are an integral over omega, you have to make sure you don't mix up, because we're going to be interchanging order of integration and such. It's a common mistake that I'm trying to warn you against doing. Integral d omega, then we have minus I omega epsilon of omega. I'm already running out of room. Have to erase some of this. E of x omega e to the minus I omega t. That's that dot product. And we can also rewrite this as one half of those two terms plus their complex conjugates, since it's these are both real quantities on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. So this takes us to this double integral over the two dummy integration frequencies, d omega, d omega prime, both from minus infinity to infinity still. And let's see, the first integral then is going to be E star of x omega prime dot E of x omega times minus I omega epsilon of omega e to the minus I times omega minus omega prime times t. That's the first term, and then the second term will be the conjugate, which we'll write this way, double integral again, d omega prime, e conjugate of x minus omega dotted into e of x minus omega prime I omega prime epsilon conjugate of omega prime and e to the minus I omega minus omega prime t. Right. So here I've used the fact that this term, for instance, is also equal to e of x omega, and so on. Some identities like that to get to this form. And in the second integral, I believe I've also switched the integration variables omega and omega prime in the notation, which you're free to do. You can call them houseboat if you want, but we'll call them omega and omega prime. So what we're aiming for with this derivation is to see what happens when a light goes through a medium and there's losses, is one aspect, and the other is if there's dispersion, if the frequency dependence is important. Usually, if you look at epsilon of omega, this is a quantity that can be determined experimentally, by the way, the real and imaginary parts are measured typically. Excuse me. Are usually measured experimentally. But they're usually some smooth functions of frequency. So, right, first I want to combine these two integrals into one expression, and then I'm going to make use of the smoothness in the next step. So e dot dd dt, our original quantity we started with that we're analyzing that came up in our proof of Poynting's theorem, is now half this double integral e conjugate of x omega prime dotted into e of x omega minus I omega epsilon of omega plus I omega prime epsilon conjugate of omega prime, and then e to the minus I omega minus omega prime t. Okay, that has combined those two expressions, and that's the reason we rewrote them in that form, to make them easy to recombine like this. So it's at this point, now invoke the smoothness of epsilon, meaning we can Taylor expand you can kind of imagine that we're most interested, probably the most important regions are going to be omega and omega prime, close to each other. So the idea is to expand omega prime epsilon conjugate of omega prime as approximately omega epsilon conjugate of omega plus a correction term that's linear in the difference, omega prime minus omega d by d omega of omega epsilon conjugate of omega. And there would be higher order terms that we are going to neglect. So when that allows me to come do some simplification of this term in square brackets, I'll just rewrite that part as minus I omega epsilon of omega plus I omega epsilon conjugate of omega minus I times omega minus omega prime d by d omega of omega epsilon conjugate of omega. And now that expression can in turn be simplified to just twice omega imaginary part of omega minus I times omega minus omega prime d by d omega of omega epsilon conjugate of omega. Okay, so let's come back to what this tells us about this E dot partial D with respect to time that arises in Poynting's theorem. The key point is that now we see a role for the, sorry, it's not imaginary part of omega, it's imaginary part of epsilon of omega. Okay, so here is the main point of that E dot partial D with respect to T, what we started working on becomes this sum of two integrals that have different or physical meaning. This first term is E conjugate of omega prime. I'm just leaving out the x dependence, which is common to everything in the equations. E star of omega prime dot E of omega times omega imaginary part of epsilon of omega. And e to the minus I omega minus omega prime t. And then this next term can be written as the time derivative of 1 half double integral d omega prime e conjugate of omega prime dot E of omega and a derivative d by d omega of omega epsilon conjugate of omega e to the minus I omega minus omega prime t. So I want to interpret now these two terms. This term represents represents the losses. The imaginary part of the dielectric constant is causing energy to be dissipated as you go into the, as a, like an electromagnetic wave goes through a medium or a conductor, right? We'll have losses. So we can think of that as the conversion of energy in the electric fields into typically heat, or it could be radiation. Like in resonant absorption or emission processes happening in the gas. Right, like if the gas is a two-level system, right, you can have it absorbing light in the, or possibly that would be actually causing losses if it's absorbing light out of an incident beam going in. The other possibility is also there if you started with all the atoms excited or molecules and you have them stimulating emission, you could have actually growth, like in a laser, you could have growth being described by this term. And this term, on the other hand, is basically the rate of change. It's describing the change in time of the effective energy density in the electric in the electrical part of the energy. Effective. Energy density. Okay. So now let's try to specialize this a little bit to a more nearly monochromatic wave going in, kind of the picture I've been talking about, but without really reflecting that in any of the mathematics so far. That means let's imagine frequencies close to some omega naught. But the frequency distribution in like a laser pulse would typically be centered on some omega naught. It would have some distribution of frequencies. And if you have a laser pulse, it can't be a delta function in reality at omega naught, because this would require an infinite amount of time to prepare such a wave by the uncertainty principle. So there will always be some delta omega spread, but we can imagine that in a lot of cases it's a rather small compared like to the dielectric constant, which is the smooth function I've been kind of imagining. So now I'm specializing to nearly monochromatic radiation. That means we can write E of xt as an envelope function, E naught of xt, times like a cosine of omega naught t plus some phase alpha. And similarly, B of xt can write similarly with an envelope function B naught of xt and the oscillating function like so, and where these are slowly varying in time. Call them envelope functions. So that if e to the I omega t in these integrals is oscillating very fast compared to the these envelope functions, we can to a good approximation take them outside the integrals, the Fourier transform. So that means we'll have equations based on that idea that look like E of x and some central time omega, central time t naught and omega would look like 1 over 2 pi, the integral over one cycle from like t naught minus, or actually n cycles, and times 2 pi over omega naught to t naught plus n times 2 pi over omega naught e naught of xt naught cosine of omega naught t plus alpha e to the I omega t dt is one way to write this integral. And we could go to the limit of n much greater than 1. And there will be a variable change. And you might want to go through some of all this math in the next couple of pages yourself. But as I said, I don't want to go through every grimy equation. But let me at least try to get to the main point here. We're going to now change variables to t prime is t minus t naught, right? Then dt prime will be dt. And then this allows us to rewrite this as e naught of x t naught that we can factor out. Then we have 1 over 2 pi, this integral minus infinity to infinity of cosine of omega naught t prime plus omega naught t naught plus alpha and e to the I omega t prime plus I omega t naught dt prime. And now that is starting to look like a simple integral we can all do. This will give, from the cosine, this will give two Dirac delta functions, namely, we'll have the envelope function and then 1 half delta of omega minus omega naught and the phase e to the minus I alpha. And a 1 half delta of omega plus omega naught e to the plus I alpha. And I think maybe there is a 2 I omega t omega naught t naught that I forgot in the notes. Okay, so let me skip to the bottom line here. and write the equation that we get out of all of this math, skipping just about half a page in the notes. And do this, include the similar term with the magnetic contribution, which looked like H dot dB dt time average. And now we are averaging over one cycle of the of this omega naught frequency, one period of that central frequency. This ends up simplifying to omega naught imaginary part of epsilon evaluated at that central frequency omega naught, the time average of E of xt dot E of xt. Plus omega naught, the imaginary part of mu at the central frequency, with h of xt dotted into h of xt, the time average of that, and then plus a time derivative of the energy density in the fields, the effective energy density U effective, which is given by this formula. U effective is a half the real part of d by d omega omega epsilon of omega times E of xt dot E of xt plus one half the real part of the derivative of omega, mu of omega, average of h dot h. And so finally we can put that all into our derivation of the Poynting theorem for this. Now, a little more specialized scenario of an electromagnetic wave with some bandwidth in frequency near a central frequency, omega naught, which is a pretty common scenario, like in a laser lab. Now we have... This is the microscopic version. We could also convert this to a finite volume if we like by integrating over a volume. But this is the microscopic version. The rate of change of this field energy density in the medium at any point plus the divergence of the Poynting vector is equal to minus J dot E, which we interpreted as the ohmic loss term. But now we have these terms also, minus omega naught, imaginary part of epsilon at omega naught, and the mean value of E squared, and then minus omega naught, imaginary part of mu of omega, mean value of h squared. So we had ohmic loss, like if we had a wave in a conductor, we saw before that leads to ohmic losses, as we expect. The wires heat up due to resistance. But also, now we extend this to maybe a gas, where we usually aren't thinking so much in conductivity, but you have maybe due to absorption, you have some losses of the radiation field due to absorption of the atoms, molecules in a gas, you can see here. But there is an important aside that this could double count losses if you're not careful. So textbook makes the key point that the dissipation can be represented in some cases by sigma, but in some cases it's better to represent it by the imaginary part of the dielectric constant. But not both. You have to choose one way to represent those kinds of losses or the other. Either through the imaginary parts of epsilon and mu or through including conductivity. But not both. Because that would be double counting. And you might refer, if you want to try to understand that point better, there's a model carried out later in chapter 7 that shows how, in fact, in a model scenario that's fairly realistic, the imaginary part of epsilon is in some cases represented as a formula that looks like sigma. And that's equation 756 and 758, where you'll see that comparison. Okay, that's all I wanted to show for this derivation. It's kind of a long, messy one. But the details are in the notes if you want to go through it and convince yourself that I haven't messed it all up. And if you find mistakes, please tell me. Okay, now we do something completely different that does not really involve such heavy math, but it involves a little more conceptual idea about where Maxwell's equations came from. How could we have come up with them without really knowing much of anything from experiment? Just based on things like having equations involving first derivatives in position and time, having all terms having the same behavior under rotations and under inversions of coordinates, right? If you have an equation and some terms are even under inversion and others in the equation are odd, it's clear those equations can't sort of make sense. And also having all terms having the same symmetry under time reversal. Because all, in Newton's laws in classical physics, all equations are still valid if we let the time arrow go backwards. So what we're going to do basically, and this is section 6.10 of the text, is look at how all these quantities transform things like E, B, our sources, vector potential, if you like, how these behave under those transformations I just described, rotation, inversion, time reversal. So let's discuss a little bit first some of the math of rotations. We've talked about that before already a little bit under rotations, right? These are orthogonal transformations of coordinates, and they are linear. Orthogonal transformations that change say the original coordinates into some transformed coordinates. And one could write that mathematically something like this, x alpha prime coordinate as a sum over beta of some transformation matrix A alpha beta times x beta, which I called equation star in the notes. And the fact that this is an orthogonal transformation means that A transpose A is the identity matrix. And moreover, if the determinant of A is plus 1, right, determinant of an orthogonal matrix has to either be plus 1 or minus 1. If it is plus 1, then this means it can be accomplished by a sequence of infinitesimal physical grabbing the axes and rotating step by step. And it's called a proper rotation. And on the other hand, if it's minus 1, then it's called an improper rotation. And it could not be achieved by a sequence of infinitesimal rotations from grabbing the axes. It requires, in general, such a proper rotation plus a coordinate inversion is needed as well, if you have this minus one case. So all our standard things that we encounter in Newtonian mechanics, like positions and velocities and momenta, of say an ith particle, velocities vi, momenta, linear momenta, pi. These all transform by equation star, as I've written it over there. And these are vectors or tensors of rank 1, if you prefer. So that's what we will call a vector. We'll encounter scalars, scalar products. Can be formed out of vectors like x1 dot x2, a dot product of two position vectors, or of a position and a velocity, anything like that, which is a dot product. These are scalars, tensors of rank 0, and these are invariant. Okay, if you have a dot product of two vectors, as you know, it doesn't matter if you wrote that dot product in this coordinate system or this coordinate system. In any coordinate system, these will be invariants. Okay. And things like the Coulomb interaction between two particles, right? This is a scalar. Again, if you have the two particles, that's one over the distance between them. It doesn't matter which rotated coordinate system you calculate that in. It's the same in every coordinate system, and you can write that actually in terms of the dot product if you expand it out. In terms of dot, you know, right, you square that, you get x1 squared, x2 squared. These are both dot products. And then you have minus twice x1 dot x2. So let's look at how differential operators behave under rotation. We'll need to know that too, to try to come up with Maxwell's equations, the structure of Maxwell's equations, without knowing anything from experiment. We can do that. That's kind of an amazing thing that comes out of this analysis. So, of course, the gradient of a scalar function will be a vector if phi is a scalar. Del dot into a vector function is, of course, going to be a scalar if v is a vector. Del dotted into a second rank tensor, like the Maxwell stress tensor we've already seen. This is a transforms under rotations as a vector. And del squared phi is, of course, a scalar also. Del squared A is a vector, and so on. Okay, but now let's consider spatial inversions. That was all under subheading A, rotations. Now let's look at inversions. Point B. This also includes in reflections. Right, like you, your three-dimensional coordinate system. What I call inversion is like the parity operator in quantum mechanics for a particle where you reflect vector x to with all of its Cartesian coordinates to its negative. That would be the normal total inversion. So if x is x x hat plus y hat plus z hat, the inversion of that is minus x x hat minus y hat minus ZZ hat. That's the parity operator in quantum mechanics. But it applies here too. You can use it in other contexts besides quantum mechanics. Reflection operator, that's inversion. The reflection operator takes you through a plane, like a mirror reflection. Just through one plane. So for instance, ry of this vector x would be x x hat minus y hat plus z hat. It leaves x and z components unchanged and just reflects the y coordinate. And neither of these cannot be achieved by any proper rotation. So now let's specialize our terminology, because there are different types of vectors. There are polar vectors, when we want to be really precise, which are often just called vectors in this language. And these transform like that equation asterisk I wrote before, like a proper rotation. So like a velocity vector v alpha prime, sum over beta, a alpha beta v beta. And moreover, on top of that, they change sign when you do an inversion. So v prime, which is I times the original vector v, if it's a polar vector, will be equal to minus v. So that's a polar vector. Then there's a second class called axial vectors that has a fundamentally different behavior. It's different in a simple way, but it's really important to understand that there's a real difference. They are also sometimes called, instead of polar and axial, sometimes you talk about these two classes as vectors and pseudo-vectors. This class is also called pseudo-vectors. And these also rotate like star under a proper rotation. But they are symmetric under inversions instead of anti-symmetric like polar vectors. And that means for an operator like L, I'll give an example in a moment, that is a pseudo-vector or an axial vector, the inversion operator on that just gives back the same vector without a change. And the way this normally happens is, in fact, it almost always happens this way, it's a cross product of two polar vectors. And of course, angular momentum is the classic example of that. I on the vector x cross p is minus x cross product with minus p, which is the same as x cross p. So anytime you see a pseudo-vector or an axial vector in a calculation or a mathematical equation, something should jump into your head. And that is that there are twists. There is something rotational or helicity, angular momentum going on in that physics. It always implies that. And that's true also for pseudoscalars, which are pretty weird functions, pretty weird things. But you can encounter them too. These are where a scalar, we said, was like a dot product, is unchanged under coordinate rotations. A pseudoscalar is also unchanged under a proper rotation. But it changes sign under an inversion. And this could happen, for instance, here is an example. Apply the inversion operator to this thing, x1 dotted into x2 cross p2, the dot product of a position with an angular momentum of maybe a different particle. This will be minus x1 dot x2 cross p2. So that's an example of a pseudoscalar. These are really fundamental ideas. The third symmetry I want to discuss, and then we will have pretty much enough to write out what Maxwell's equations had to look like from these three ideas of rotations, inversions, and next under time reversal. Is point C in this discussion, time reversal. Okay. And here we're using the idea that we expect invariance under the time reversal operation, like the classical laws of physics have. T goes to minus T. And so this T operator, I'll write it in this kind of capital T notation, acting on, for instance, a differential in time, will also be minus dt, and so a partial derivative, partial with respect to time, like in Kerr's and Maxwell's equations, those are quantities odd under time reversal. So let's look at all our electromagnetic entities under these operations. Classify them. So we'll write the entity, the behavior under proper rotation, behavior under inversions, under time reversal, and give their overall behavior. I wrote this table is in the notes too, if you don't want to recopy it. So charge, very simple quantity, a bunch of stuff, right? This, of course, is a scalar under rotations, and it's even under inversions. It is even under time reversal. And so this we can call a true scalar. What about the E field? Right, think of the equation del dot E is rho over epsilon naught. So E is a vector. It is odd under inversions, because del is odd under inversions, and so del dot E is even, so yeah, E must be odd. Under time reversal, it is even, and so this is a polar vector. B field, we have an equation like curl of E plus dB dt, right, is zero, which gives us a clue about the behavior of the B field. The under proper rotation, it's a vector, but it's even under inversions. It's odd under time reversal. It has to be for this to, for both terms to make sense here when added together. And so B is a pseudo vector or an axial vector. A current density J, that's a vector, it's odd under inversion, right? It's rho times velocity, so it's odd under inversion. So, and it's odd under time reversal, and so it is a polar vector also. So if one didn't know anything about experiment, imagine there is some behavior of fields in nature that involve some connections between a vector field and a pseudo-vector field or an axial vector field and corresponding sources. Then what could be related if we suppose there are only first derivatives and these two vectors and corresponding sources and linear relations, right? Then we could make a list of behavior under rotation, under inversion, under time reversal, and include all the terms that have common behavior under all three operations. So let's say we have a vector under rotations, odd behavior under inversions, even time reversal behavior, and combine all of the quantities that have those behaviors. And there's only one, E is the only quantity here that has all those behaviors. If we look at all the functions that are vectors under rotation, also odd under inversion, but odd under time reversal, now there are three such things. There's dE dt, there is curl of B, and there's J. So there ought to be an equation involving those three things. If we look at quantities that are a pseudo-vector under rotation, meaning they are even under inversion, and let's consider the ones that are odd under time reversal. There's only one of these, and that's B. And if we look at the things that are pseudo-vector under rotation, even under inversion, and even under time reversal, there are just two, dB dt, and curl of E. Only those. And if we looked for a scalar under the terms that are invariant under rotation and invariant under inversions, so they're a real scalar, not a pseudo-scalar, there are two things, del dot E and rho. So there ought to be an equation involving those two things with constant coefficients between them. And the last is the pseudoscalar possibility, pseudoscalar, which is odd under inversion and odd under time reversal, there is only del dot B. Now that's the nature of experiments. But if anyone finds a magnetic monopole, we will have to add some things to this table. A magnetic monopole would have to be involve a charge density of magnetic charge, if it is ever found to exist. That would add a new term in Maxwell's equations, that del dot B would equal rho m times the constant. It would also mean that there would be a new term in this equation, which would be like a magnetic current density, which would be like rho m times the velocity, just like J is rho times velocity. So I think this table gives a lot of insight into how Maxwell's equations had to look. Without knowing experiments, you could predict these relations. If you only assume linear relations, first derivatives, common behavior under these transformations of all terms in each equation, and that there is a field that is a vector, and even under time reversal, and there's another field that's a pseudo-vector and odd under time reversal. I think that's pretty wacky. And that, I guess, is all I have. I could do one more thing. I need this before I let you go. I want to share something with you, which are snippets from ENM2 of 20 years ago, put together in this form.
All right. Okay.
Students in the class did this. I did.
All right. Call me Nutty.
These are words right from my actual lectures.
Call me Nutty. We continue in our quest for, faster than the speed of light particle. The charges are going to jiggle backward in time.